This is the ARC Energy Ideas Podcast with Peter Terzakian and Jackie Forrest, exploring trends that influence the energy business.
Welcome to the ARC Energy Ideas Podcast. I'm Jackie Forrest.
And I'm Peter Terzakian. Welcome back. So we've got quite an agenda here of things to talk about. There's all sorts of new things. There's Cenovus announcing a GHG reduction a few weeks ago.
Yes, yeah, and related, BlackRock, the world's largest asset manager, making changes to address climate risk in terms of how they invest.
And there's some economic outlooks that are changing into 2020. You know, some people starting to think about reducing economic activity projections, in other words, GDP, based on various factors, including this whole coronavirus thing, which has shades of SARS. Well, actually, the coronavirus, I'm told, is a related strain to that whole SARS episode, which was, when was that, 2003 or something like that?
Yeah, it was quite some time ago. Yeah. I would say it seems very early to, if it's going to become that large, but if it does, then it can have an effect on the economy.
Yeah. It did have an effect on the economy whenever it was 17 years ago. You've got a bit of a cold. But
I do. I hope it's not the coronavirus.
No,
don't worry,
not
Peter.
Either. Yeah, okay, good.
Luckily, it won't go through the audio file to all our listeners. So bear with me. I've got a little bit of a cold today.
Okay, let's talk about Cenovus and their announcement. What the net zero? They're joining the club?
Well, I was excited to see this news. I think if you go back just a couple of episodes ago, we made our predictions for 2020.
We said
that we thought more producers would make ambitious targets. And look at that. Didn't take more than a couple of weeks. I guess Cenovus is listening to our podcast, maybe.
Yes, there you go.
Yeah. And I was excited about this pledge. When you look at this, plus the pledges made by CNRL and MEG, that accounts for about a third of all crude oil production in Western Canada being backed by aggressive GHG emission reduction goals. And if I go further and put Suncor in the group, because Suncor actually has a very aggressive goal for a 30% reduction by 2030, then it would be almost half of all oil production in Western Canada backed by very ambitious targets for reductions in GHG emissions.
Yeah, you know, the producers have been thinking about this type of thing for actually quite a while because of the intense environmental pressure on the industry that goes back 10 years, certainly the last half dozen years. And now, as we've talked about in our podcasts over the last 6 months, the intense pressure from financial institutions, the new policymakers, to get companies to reduce their GHG emissions. And now we're talking not only just reduce GHG emissions, but go to this target of net zero. Well, maybe for our listeners, what is net zero?
Well, you know, the net is important. And for the Canadian oil and gas producers, the definition is that their emissions that are directly on their site, and for the case of Cenovus, also indirect emissions associated like with the power that they may use. So the power may be generated off their site, but they're going to count that too because there are emissions that end up in the atmosphere, that they reduce those emissions either directly within their own site, or if they do emit CO2 on their site, they offset it by reducing emissions somewhere else. So for instance, they could plant trees somewhere, or they could sequester carbon somewhere else to offset the emissions that they're making.
So net means basically the difference between what they emit and what they offset it with, either by reducing what they emit or planting trees, et cetera. So the difference between the two ends up being zero, hence net zero.
Right.
But I want to come back to that, what they emit, because there's a lot of vagaries around that. There's a sort of the direct emissions that are obviously coming out of the exhaust stacks of the industrial plant, whether it's oil and gas or steel or cement or whatever. So that's one.
Yeah, and you know what, let's introduce these terms to our listeners.
Yeah, I think it's really important.
You're going to hear this a lot more and actually even further in the podcast when we talk about some other corporate goals. So what's called scope one emissions is exactly what you just talked about, Peter. So from your gate, the assets that you own.
In the chain link fence.
Yep, what are the direct CO2 emissions coming from your operations? That's called scope one. And so some companies, when they say that they're committing to net zero, they're talking about only their scope one emissions.
Right.
That they're only really going to account for the things that come within their gates,
right?
Either by reducing emissions or offsetting them by capturing emissions somewhere
else. So let me offer some simple math. 100 units of GHGs coming up from scope one within the gates. The company reduces, say, over the next 10 years, that down to 70. So now they've reduced 30 from the original 100. And then from that remaining 70, they may go find other solutions, say, nature-based solutions or...
Or sequestering carbon somewhere else.
CO2 sequestration to get rid of the remaining 70. So your scope one, net zero. What's scope two?
Scope two is the direct emissions from other sources of energy that you bring onto your site. For example, if you import power, well, there's greenhouse gas emissions associated with making that power if it's coming from fossil fuels. Mm-hmm. And so you have to account for those emissions. Or it could be if you're importing natural gas onto your site to burn, it's not just burning the natural gas that creates emissions, but processing and developing that natural gas and bringing it to your site. Mm-hmm. There were emissions associated with that too. And so you may commit to both scope one and scope two, where you're accountable for the emissions that are created for the energy sources that you use that were imported to your site.
And it gets a little bit fuzzy. I mean, do you account for, let's just say, the dump trucks and pickup trucks and all the emissions that of the vehicles, the train that goes in and out to take the goods away? Like, is that part of the scope two as well?
Generally, some of that is under scope three. Mm-hmm. So scope three is then indirect emissions from other sources, like the greenhouse gas emissions for transportation of your products to market.
Right.
So that's scope three. I do want to come back to Synovus because they actually, I want to give them some credit. They had the most defined set of goals here that I've seen in the Canadian mm-hmm. context, because they're not only saying that they're going to reduce their GHG emission by 30% by 2030, that includes scope one and scope two.
Mm-hmm.
But they also have other goals like holding absolute emissions flat. So even if they're going to grow their production, they don't mm-hmm. want to have absolute emissions go up. So that is more aggressive than some of the other Canadian players. They also have other ESG goals like spending more with Indigenous groups, goals to reclaim well sites, restore caribou land. So actually their targets go beyond just the GHG. And then, of course, they have that net zero goal mm-hmm, for 2050.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, because as we've discussed in previous podcasts, it's ESG, environment, social governance, that is being measured now by financial institutions. The metrics are being agreed upon. And so the E, environmental performance, dominantly emissions, that GHGs, et cetera, are becoming quite clear. But the S and the G is also important.
It is. And I think right now, if ESG were written, the font of the letter E would be like 5 or 6 times or maybe even larger than the other two letters. But I do think over time, you're starting to see already investors ask more questions about the S and the G, the social and governance. Mm-hmm. And so I think some of these things will really differentiate companies into the future by focusing on all aspects of business risk around the environmental, social, and governance. I do want to bring up, you know, why do these types of goals matter in the context of Canada? You talked about it. Investors want you to do it. But I also think within Canada, it's important that we see these big commitments being made, because there is a conversation in Canada that Canada cannot make the goals of the Paris Agreement, which is a 30% reduction in GHG emissions by 2030, if we have an oil and gas industry. And we saw that during the election. We had politicians saying, well, we'll have to just shut the industry down. That's the only way we can meet these domestic goals. And I think that narrative's just being flipped upside down by these targets, because in reality, if these companies, which represent half of all the production from Canada, mm-hmm. deliver on these goals, and I believe they will, we will see the oil and gas sector contribute in a big way to Canada making its goals, not make it impossible, which seems to be the narrative held by a lot of folks.
Well, the narrative is definitely changing in terms of how Canada is going to achieve its goals and the recognition that the oil and gas industry needs to be part of the solution. The interesting thing to me is that the oil and gas industry has been under intense environmental scrutiny for at least a decade, certainly the last couple of years. The influence of the financial markets coming in and dictating these new policies is very notable. And so given that they've had to deal with this thing, I believe actually they have a head start over many of the other industries in Canada that are going to fall under this net zero by 2050 directive from the Prime Minister. So we'll see. Ironically, it could be that the industries that have historically been the most villainized are the ones that actually now have the most tacit knowledge experience that they can hopefully share with other industries across the country that are large emitters.
Hey, and I want to have a bit of a rant here, but you know, and I both get calls from the media when things like this happen. Mm-hmm. And I got a number of calls from the media when Synovus made their announcement. And I think there's a bit of a double standard here. When companies like Synovus or oil and gas companies, they make these big commitments for reductions like net zero 2050. you get a lot of skepticism. Like, well, they don't really have a plan, or they didn't really, what technologies even exist to do that? And I feel it's a bit of a double standard, because if the Liberal government commits to net zero 2050, or the 77 other countries that have committed, people applaud them and they don't expect them to have a plan. Like, really, are we going to know what technologies over the next 30 years exactly will get us there? So I feel like there's a lot of skepticism that isn't really fair, because we don't apply that lens to other groups or organizations that make these type of commitments.
Yeah, I hear you. I would say that the skepticism originates because there has historically been a lot of, I'll call it, denial or retrenchment in dealing with this issue. But I also believe that you're right, that we are in an era where skepticism, which leads to outright cynicism, is not where we need to be. And that companies, whether they're domestic Canadian ones or international oil and gas companies, who are also, some of them, becoming very progressive on the climate change file, we have to appreciate that, okay, we have crossed the threshold from denial into action, and that some of the big companies can be the leaders in trying to take every ton that we can of CO2 out of the emissions profile that needs to be done.
Yeah, well, and I just say, if you've got a CEO of a public company making a commitment like this, I think that I would believe that that's going to occur more than a political leader who maybe only has a four-year lifetime.
Yeah.
So I think that when companies make these types of commitments publicly, they intend to deliver on them.
Yeah, I think the cynicism is definitely not warranted at this time. I think we have to encourage more to be done. And well, it's interesting. I mean, it's not just oil and gas that are committing to these sorts of things. There's all sorts of companies. Microsoft, for example.
Yeah, I think we should talk about that. So Microsoft put out a target just recently in the last week, which I have to say is the most aggressive carbon target I've ever seen a corporation take on. And I think you're going to start to see others. They actually even created a new term. They created a term called carbon negative in 10 years. So
more jargon. Huh?
Yeah, this is carbon negative. So what they're saying is that in 10 years, they will actually be getting rid of more carbon than they're creating. So that's carbon negative. So not just net zero, but actually you're getting rid of more carbon than you're creating annually. And actually, you know, that's in 10 years. And they're saying that by 2050, because they're going to be carbon negative, they're actually going to have sequestered or got rid of all of the carbon emissions that they've generated as a company back to the 1970s. Mm-hmm. So they are truly going to have no carbon footprint, even for the history of their organization.
Is this scope 4 then? Is that what it is?
Well, that's scope 3, but they're going back in time because, you know, the CO2 you put up in the 70s is still up there.
Yeah.
So they're saying, hey, we're responsible for that too. So not only are we going to get into a position where every year we're taking more out of the atmosphere than we're putting in, but over a series of years, we're going to actually take back everything we emitted into the atmosphere.
Okay. I think this is all laudable. It shows leadership. I do want to caution, though, that there seems to be a ratcheting up of, or maybe I should say sort of a moving of the goalposts here very quickly, where there's sort of this one-upmanship. We've gone from, okay, let's follow the Paris Agreement, which is reduce emissions by 30% relative to 2005 by 2030. Then we migrated into, okay, we're going from limiting temperature rise from 2 degrees C to 1.5 degrees C. Now we started talking about net zero. Now what's this term?
Carbon negative.
And
removing all your historical emissions.
Okay.
Oh, I've got something else to add though. Like, if that wasn't aggressive enough, they are also taking into account all their scope 3 emissions. So it's not just their scope 1 and scope 2.
Mm-hmm.
It includes all the emissions from other sources, like the greenhouse gas emissions from transporting all their products to market, which by their account represents something like 75% of all their emissions. So they're taking responsibility for like the widest scope of emissions within that context of negative emissions.
All right, that's great. But I think now action has to follow because, okay, I'm now going to show my cynical side, which I just ranted against. But you know, you can't continue to ratchet and ratchet and ratchet the goalposts, because by human nature, we need goals that we can articulate and reach. And every time you move the goalposts, it creates new jargon, new goalposts. Mm-hmm. These things are all fuzzy. One company's definition of net zero is different from another definition of net negative, whatever you want to call it. It's just
the like, new term, net negative.
Let us agree on some specific goals. Like in Canada, I think we agreed to removing 79 megatons. That's a concrete number by a certain time frame. Like, give me the goal and I will work as hard as possible to achieve that goal. That is the way most companies and the individuals within a company work. And so all this is fine, but I think that we do need to land on a common set of goals and vernacular, in other words, definitions of where we're headed with this stuff. Because the reality of the situation is that the emissions continue to go up unabated. And regardless of what Microsoft and Starbucks and all these other companies do, there is a colossal industry that is not in the free market in the developing countries that continue to pump out more and more coal-fired power plants and so on that offset probably what Microsoft does just in one day.
Yeah, anyway, that's a good point. They have 16 million tons a year, which is basically 0.3% of all U.S. emissions or 3% of Canada's emissions. So you're right. The power sector in some developing countries would be much larger than that. You did mention Starbucks. For our audience that's not following every announcement around this stuff, they this week plan to cut GHG emissions by 50% by 2030.
Right.
I didn't really understand what scope it was. Now we need to ask all these questions. They made a goal to reduce single-use and reusable packaging, which I like. Because I feel a little guilty with all these paper cups, so I hope they come up with a solution.
No, I mean, even the Chinese, I read somewhere, they're getting rid of plastic bags for groceries and things like that. So, I think this is all headed in the right direction. Why don't we talk about the financial side? Because as I said before, the finance industry, in other words, investors, are driving the agenda, the policies, so to speak, the environmental policies, far harder than government. In fact, I would say that if the policies, in quotations, that the financial industry is imposing upon companies were being done by government, there would be an uproar against government. But because it's the investor community, it has a lot more potency.
It does. And the world's largest investors spoke out in the last week. BlackRock's Larry Fink has an annual letter that he writes to the CEOs of the companies he invests in and the management firms that he invests in. And this year, he definitely made some news because he basically said that climate change is going to become a fundamental force in reshaping finance, that climate risk is investment risk. And he thinks that climate risk, sooner than most anticipate, is going to cause a reallocation of capital into sustainable investing. And it's probably worth just describing what BlackRock is.
Yeah, I think they have the world's largest investor, basically, with $7 trillion of assets under management and pension funds and sovereign wealth funds and so on. So they're very, very influential, very notable. And the market definitely responded to the words of Larry Fink. But he didn't call for full divestment.
No. You know, an important thing he said is that the energy transition takes decades and we will need hydrocarbons for some time to come. He said the technology does not exist to cost effectively replace hydrocarbons. So that is something that I think was important to acknowledge. It's not a divestment move per se, although he did talk about divesting specifically of thermal coal producers if they generate more than 25% of their revenue from thermal coal, if they're a miner.
Mm-hmm.
But other than that, he's not talking about divestment. He's talking about looking at companies that are assessing their ESG risk, reporting on it, and reducing their ESG risk. So to me, he's saying, you know, I could still invest in oil and gas, but it has to be a company that's seen as sustainable and reducing their exposure to ESG risk by lowering their emissions and also other ESG risks that they could encounter.
Yeah. It's all very notable. I mean, one of the risks with this sort of thing, the imposition of these sorts of restrictions, I'll call them almost sanctions effectively, like I'm not going to invest in you, that's effectively a sanction, is that there is a trend for migration to jurisdictions of operations, whether it's coal mining or steel or making widgets of whatever sort, into jurisdictions where they are far less efficient at manufacturing or mining stuff, do not have the same emissions restrictions. So I'm saying this can cause actually a negative a phenomena when it comes to emissions.
I think what you're saying, Peter, is that you're not dealing with the demand side. So yes, you're going to take capital away from those companies that produce coal, in this case, mining coal. But if you don't change the demand side, someone else will just do that, and it won't change how much coal is really consumed in the world.
Well, that's true. Actually, it's more the supply side. So let me give you an example. You know, country A has coal mining and coal-fired power plants. They introduce, either through the investors or government policies, that say, okay, no more coal. Then what happens is that the coal operations are just pushed into a neighboring country. And the neighboring country has coal-fired power plants and supplies the electricity into the country that imposed the restrictions. So actually, not only have you just basically outsourced your emissions problem, calling yourself green, you have also probably exported the problem into a country where the regulations were less than yours were originally, and the operation's far less efficient. Mm-hmm.
But deep down, the only reason that second plant started up is because someone still wants that product.
Right.
And
okay,
so,
fair enough.
You know, so if you got to deal with the demand, and that's my issue with the divestment movement in general, is that, yeah, we can say we're not going to give money to certain types of companies, but as long as people want to buy the stuff, I think there'll be someone producing it.
Yeah.
And so it doesn't deal with the root cause, which is how do we shut down all these coal-fired power plants?
Yeah.
Like,
well,
that is more important. And he didn't actually talk about divesting of utilities that consume coal, which is interesting.
Right. I mean, another way to think about it is, why are you cutting the best players off the team? You know, the most already environmentally responsible and efficient, and only to add more inefficient players on the team, because for the whole team as a whole, it becomes a liability.
Right. You're starving capital from these companies that you've earmarked, which are probably mostly public Western companies.
Right.
And then you're just going to create more market share for the other players that you're not investing in potentially.
All of this really says is that the imposition of these financial regulations, if you will, the ESG metrics and so on, are good as long as they don't push too far and create unintended consequences that can actually exacerbate the problem instead of solve something.
But I do think that this is positive in that it shows that ESG and climate risk are becoming mainstream.
Yeah.
We've talked about this, but if BlackRock's doing it, I also think it should increase the capital flowing into sustainable investments and motivate more companies to get the criteria that would allow them to make that sustainable
checkbox. Well, BlackRock's not the first, right? They're just,
they're just not the
biggest. Yeah. I mean, this has been happening for the better part of half a dozen years. And I think before BlackRock made this announcement, certainly, I mean, the number of investment managers, I heard a number is like $11.5, $12 trillion worth of assets under management would already.
Well, and I think one issue has been that there isn't standardized reporting, and sometimes one organization will say that these are green and somebody else will say they're not. Mm-hmm. So I think BlackRock coming into this may create more standardization, actually, that was mentioned.
Right.
And we need to have more standards so that companies are compared fairly, apples to apples. And so I think them coming in is another positive. So I also think that, you know, sometimes if you want to find a green fund, you may find that there's a lack of choice. By BlackRock saying that they're going to convert most of their investments into sustainable funds and passive funds and different options, there should be more for individual consumers. There should be more options out there for people to invest in sustainable funds and sustainable companies.
Right. And at the end of the day, from a corporational standpoint, whether you're producing coffee or oil and gas or whatever, the directive in a highly competitive world that is increasingly conscious about climate change, the strategy is be the low-cost producer with the best product, and best product now includes the dimension of utility that is lowest carbon.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and I think we already talked about, we have a theory that over time, ESG-friendly companies will be differentiated and valued more. Well, I think if BlackRock is moving in this direction, that may just accelerate that timeline.
I mean, what that does is it affects the cost of capital of companies. There's going to be discrimination. In other words, company A, you emit too much, so you're not going to get any investment. Company B, you're showing a lot of progress, you're going to get it.
Mm-hmm. And this may happen faster than people think.
It's already happening.
Because of these sorts of moves.
Yeah.
Yep. Okay, let's quickly switch to the economic outlook. And it seems like kind of a weird transition, but this week the IMF made headlines that they made a minor revision to their 2020 economic growth And one of the first reasons they cited for the revision is climate change, warning that the world's economy is increasingly vulnerable to climate change and weather-related risks. They also cited trade wars. I just found this interesting because it seems today that everybody is talking about climate change. You know, it's not very often I've heard a short-term outlook from the IMF talking about climate change. And you also have central bankers getting, you know, talking about climate change. So I just found that kind of an interesting headline from the IMF this week.
Yeah, and I think you're going to see more of this. I have to say, in the very near term, I'm a little bit skeptical. Not cynical, skeptical, because you know, a lot of people talk about changing behaviors, buying electric cars. I mean, and God knows how many times we've talked about that on our podcast and so on. And oil consumption continues to go up. Emissions continue to go up. And so now we're saying, well, this is going to affect GDP. GDP is a very complicated dynamic, the global economy, many, many different variables. In the near term, I don't know, near term being in this year, over the course of a decade, yeah, sure, I can buy into that. That there has to be caution. And that's why there are a lot of financial institutions that are asking companies or demanding that the companies show disclosure about how you're going to deal with the problem.
Yeah, I agree. For 2020, I think the trade war is probably a bigger implication.
Well, trade wars, or even this coronavirus thing or whatever. I mean, those are big issues.
So let's talk about the outlooks for 2020 now that the IMF put their outlook in. It was a slight revision down, but actually the outlook this year for the economy is probably better than if we were going to talk about this 1 year ago. Mm-hmm. We had a great year for the stock market in 2019. The Dow Jones went up like 22%, NASDAQ up 35%. The TSX went up 20%, but that's because it was being weighed down by all those Canadian oil and gas stocks. So that's probably why it a bit underperformed, but stellar year. And because when you think about this time last year, if you remember, there was that big dip in the stock market right near the end of the year. A lot of uncertainty coming into 2019. A lot of predictions that we're going to get a recession at some point in the year. You know, the head of the Economist magazine has markets in the age of anxiety. Mm-hmm. And this year, the mindset has really changed. Most forecasts are that we're going to have low interest rates. Trade tensions are easing. It's an election year. Trump's going to do everything to not have a recession in the United States. And most outlooks are that we won't see a recession. Now, these agencies can be wrong, but most of them are assuming slightly higher growth in 2020 than what we just had in 2019.
Yeah, I think notwithstanding the unforeseen on the downside, 2020 is looking like pretty decent momentum carrying on from last year. Like, I don't think we're going to see that kind of stock market appreciation again, but from the economic indicators, as good or slightly better than 2019 looks likely.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and we've looked through like the Bloomberg consensus, the World Bank, IMF, Goldman Sachs. In general, global economic outlook, similar to last year, a little bit higher. U.S. is deemed to be similar to last year by most of those agencies. And China slowing down slightly, but maybe only 0.1 or 0.2%. Now, the one thing that could really change this, I think, is the trade war. This phase one of the trade deal was signed and gives people some hope that the worst is behind. But I would just caution that there wasn't really that many tariffs removed because of that phase one deal. There's still 25% tariffs on $250 billion of Chinese goods. Now, the hope is that this is just phase one and that there'll be other phases to the agreement and we'll see those tariffs come off. But I think, you know, if that isn't resolved, then that could slow down some of these economic outlooks.
Right.
Now, why we like to talk about this topic is we love to talk about oil demand, and GDP is the most important thing to look at when you think about oil demand growth in 2020. And based on these outlooks, it looks like we're going to have in the range of a million or a million, a bit more, oil demand growth in 2020, which is similar to what we had in 2019 as well.
Yeah, no, it keeps ratcheting up. So what are we at now, 101 million barrels per day or some staggering
number? Yes, that would be 101 kind of annual average
So
for 2020.
Are we going from 100 on average to 101?
Yes, that's the annual average. There's a lot of variability quarter to quarter. So yeah, oil demand keeps growing and the electric cars are not going to affect it this year. The biggest thing that will affect that outlook will be if the economic growth slows down, then we're going to start to see oil demand come in lower than that. But based on the outlooks, I just feel like there's a lot more confidence or conviction in the outlook this year than maybe a year ago when there was a lot more uncertainty.
Yeah, there was a lot of, well, you never know what's going to happen. You know, something could sideswipe you. Like, again, I'm bringing it up over and over again, but the coronavirus kind of thing, not saying it's going to be a big deal, but it's that kind of thing that comes at you from left field that can change.
Oh, another big one could be an oil price spike. Let's say we have a massive outage of oil supply.
Sure, if there's a military action in the Middle East, who knows?
Yeah. So don't get too excited. For those listeners that were getting excited, there's never certainty. But in terms of the consensus view, there is definitely more of a consensus this year of growth similar to last year. Well, with that, I think we can wrap it up. We've covered a lot of topics here.
We have.
Yeah. So if you enjoyed this podcast, please tell someone else about us and rate us on the app that you listen to.
For more ideas and insights, visit arcenergyinstitute.com.